Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com by this and other NPR member stations. And Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Half a Life by V.S. Naipaul, author of Enigma of Arrival and A House for Mr. Biswas.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Donald Cousins, is a priest who has written reflective books about what it's like to be a priest today. He's the author of The Changing Face of the Priesthood, a reflection on the priest's crisis of soul, and the new book, Sacred Silence, Denial and the Crisis in the Church. The book reflects on the current sex abuse scandal, but Cousins also writes about what he sees as a systemic problem, a still feudal church is struggling to meet the modern world. Cousins is the former secretary and vicar for clergy and religious at the Diocese of Cleveland. He now teaches religious studies at John Carroll University. Yesterday, the Vatican announced its appointments to a new commission which will revise the bishop's zero-tolerance policy for priests accused of sexual abuse. The Vatican opposes zero-tolerance because it ignores the Church's statute of limitations, doesn't protect the due process rights of accused priests, and defines sexual abuse too ambiguously. Cousins sees a positive and negative side to overturning zero tolerance.
Many priests today feel that they have been put in grave danger with that Dallas policy. And I think the Vatican was right to acknowledge that the definition of sexual abuse was very, very broad. There was no distinction between, say, a priest who makes an inappropriate remark to a teenager and between a priest who has a sexual experience with a teenager. So from that perspective, I'm glad the Vatican vetoed or at least called into question a good deal of the Dallas policy. From the negative side, it tells me that the Vatican still does not understand the church in the U.S. For example, the Vatican policy was critical of the bishops because they indicated that they would report to the authorities allegations of sexual misconduct. Well, that's the law, and we have to have the bishops conforming to law in this country. So there is a positive side to this action by the Vatican and also a negative side that tells me the Vatican doesn't understand the real nature of the church here in the United States.
How do you think the church should deal with priests accused of sexual abuse?
Well, first of all, they need to deal with priests accused of sexual abuse according to the law. Failure to do so is going to put children at risk, and it is going to further diminish their own credibility. I think if a priest is a true pedophile, an adult, usually a male, who is consistently and attracted sexually to prepubescent children, that man should never do ministry again. That doesn't mean he has to be drummed out of the priesthood, but he should never be allowed to have any kind of contact with parishioners in general and children in particular.
Why doesn't it mean he should be drummed out of the priesthood?
Our theology teaches that once a man is ordained a priest, he remains a priest until he dies. When people say a man should be thrown out of the priesthood, they are talking about a process that has been commonly referred to as defrocking of the priest. So in a sense, you throw him out of the priesthood. He's not allowed to wear clerical clothes. He's not to be allowed to be addressed as father. Whatever is necessary for the safety of children and teenagers should be done. If a priest is found guilty of gross sexual imposition on a young child or a teenager, should never be allowed to minister again as a priest. And in some cases, that does require that he be defrocked. But I think that in many cases, a priest doesn't have to suffer that indignity of being defrocked. I'm for defrocking priests if the safety of teenagers and children requires it.
My guest is Donald Cousins. He is a priest in the Cleveland Diocese. He teaches at John Carroll University in the Cleveland area. His new book is called Sacred Silence, Denial and the Crisis in the Church. In writing about the sexual abuse scandal in the church, you write about how the church is trying to reconcile itself with the modern world, and that leads you to discuss that process when you were first being ordained in the mid-60s. And before you were ordained, you had to take an oath dating back to 1910.
The oath against modernism.
What was that about?
Well, the church was very threatened with the initiatives taken by the Enlightenment or the designers of the Enlightenment that go back centuries. And so the whole scientific thrust of a rational approach to life was very upsetting to many church authorities. In the area of scripture scholarship especially, there was concern that we would be unfaithful to that which was revealed by God. So to maintain the faith and the purity of the faith, bishops, clergy, seminarians about to be ordained, anyone being appointed to a church office was required to take the oath against modernism. It's a marvelous example of fear and anxiety and an attempt to control what people think and believe, which over the long run certainly hasn't worked at all. So priests between 1910 and 1967 were asked to take an oath against modernism just before they were ordained. And if you were teaching at a seminary or a pontifical university, you were required to take that oath every fall before the academic year began.
And what did you have to promise when you took the oath?
Well, you had to promise to accept the teaching of the church as it was determined by the Vatican, as it was determined by the tradition of the church and the teaching office of the church, as if there would be no new developments or new insights. We were asked to swear that we believed that the author of the Pentateuch was Moses, even though scripture scholars were very confident that the authorship of the Pentateuch was quite different. I think it's fair to say that seminarians before 1965 were not really encouraged to think critically, to challenge the propositions presented to them in the seminary. You might say that it was a form of apologetics. We were in the seminary to learn what the church taught, how to defend it, and how to argue it persuasively. And so it wasn't really a true graduate school. Now, to an extent, I understand that you do need to train future priests to present clearly and in a compelling way the teachings of the church. But God help us if our priests are not free to think critically. That should serve the truth, not threaten it.
Did you ever consider not taking the oath against modernism?
I was very disturbed when the oath was put before me, and I think some of my classmates were, although I certainly can't speak for them. I don't believe I considered not signing the oath for any considerable amount of time, and I'm not proud to say that. I think it is a very good example of my own denial and the denial of my classmates. We compromised, and we signed the oath. We who were to be preachers of the truth, men who were to be trusted, men whose word was all important, we began our priesthood with an oath that we really didn't believe.
When the Second Vatican Council made its changes and the oath of modernism was rescinded, did it make you think that the church's rules were more arbitrary, that they were the rules of men, not God, and they were changeable, they were subject to political processes, you know, a rule may come and go in your own lifetime?
I think most priests and the laity were able to make a distinction between rules that were created by the church, rules that seemed to be part of our tradition, and those teachings of the church that were clearly the result of what we believe to be divine revelation. And so you have to make a distinction between rules that are apparently from God and rules that have come to us down through the centuries created by church officials. The most clear example of a rule that has not been revealed to us by God would be mandatory celibacy for diocesan priests in the Latin Rite.
How has your view of the celibate life changed as you've gotten older? Has it changed?
It has changed. It remains a mystery to me. I think there is a wonderful richness to the celibate life, and I think we'll have it with the church throughout the church's history. A number of young men today and older men are studying for the priesthood in religious congregations or religious communities, communities like the Benedictines, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, and the Jesuits. These men want to be priests, and they choose to be celibate because they want to live in a religious community and engage in the ministry that has been traditionally associated with their religious congregation. We will always, in my judgment, have celibate priests. The issue for me is the necessity of mandatory celibacy for the diocesan priest. While it's a blessing in many ways, and I've tried to write positively about the effect of celibacy in the diocesan priest's life, it takes a real toll. There's a certain part of life that allows each of us to experience human suffering. There's no escaping human suffering, but unnecessary suffering should never be embraced. I think there's a great deal of emotional suffering, especially the suffering of loneliness, in mandatory celibacy for diocesan priests.
Do you think that loneliness gets any easier or more difficult as the priest gets older? Does the priest, in your experience or in your personal experience, have you felt any more connected or less connected to other people with age?
I'm going to mention a kind of progression, and this certainly has all kinds of exceptions, but for the young priest, maybe between the ages of 25 and 35 or so, often the difficulty of celibacy is the absence of a sexual life, an active sexual life. And then in the middle years of the priest, very often the pain of celibacy is not having children, a son and daughter or sons and daughters that make up a family. And then as the priest moves into his late middle years and older, very often the pain of celibacy is not having someone with whom you can share your life. I think the loneliness factor is constant throughout all three of these more or less stages that I've mentioned, but it can become especially strong in the late middle years and senior years of a priest's life.
If a church wanted to change the mandatory celibacy for priests, what would it have to do to make that change?
The church is an ecclesiastical monarchy. So the Pope, with his signature on a document, could change mandatory celibacy for diocesan priests that quickly.
If there was a new ruling that say, priests, you can get married whenever you want to. It doesn't have to even be before you're ordained. If you want to get married now, you can, and you can remain a priest. Is that something you would hope to do?
The paradox is that I have found my life to be remarkably rich and filled with close friends. I know the joy and support of a wonderful family. So I can't say that without question I would marry. But my own theology of celibacy is such that I believe I would pray to have the wisdom to know whether or not I was being called to marriage.
Father Donald Cousins is the author of the new book, Sacred Silence, Denial, and the Crisis in the Church. He teaches at John Carroll University. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Donald Cousins, is a priest who also writes about the lives of priests. His new book is called Sacred Silence. Donald Cousins, your new book, Sacred Silence, is subtitled Denial and the Crisis in the Church. In what parts of the church life do you think it's in denial?
I think that in terms of the crisis that we are now talking about in terms of sexual abuse of minors and children, there is a fair amount of denial. And I think in many other areas of the church, the vocation crisis, for example, our seminaries are probably only half filled at the present time. Our novitiates, where young women prepare for lives as nuns and sisters, they're not full either. And until recently, there was a fair amount of denial that there were fairly large numbers of gay men in the priesthood and in our seminaries. When the Changing Face of the Priesthood came out 2 years ago, the book was both widely praised and also strongly condemned, especially in certain church circles. I think much of that negative reaction to the book was due to a sense that we can't face certain issues right now because it would harm the church. We've done far more harm towards the priesthood, and we've harmed the reputation of the church by being so afraid to honestly, compassionately, and respectfully address issues that need to be addressed.
You mentioned the issue of homosexuality in the church. I think that must be a particularly hard issue for you to discuss. I think I've read enough of your work to know that you're not homophobic, but to raise the issue that perhaps there's a proportionately large population of gay men in the priesthood and to wonder about what that means for the priesthood might put you in the position of looking homophobic, like it's something you're worried about. Can you talk a little bit about the difficulties of trying to talk about that in an open way?
Well, it's very difficult to talk about the issue of homosexuality and the priesthood in the seminaries today, precisely, Terry, because of what you've just mentioned there, the fear that you'll be identified as homophobic. And I truly hope I am not homophobic. I don't think I am. And I've had a number of gay priests that and some seminarians whom I do not know write to me or call to thank me for raising the issue as I did in the Changing Face of the Priesthood. It's a very tricky subject to address. I do want to say that I think the Vatican has broken through its own denial. The Vatican has recently acknowledged that there is an issue of a higher percentage of gay priests and seminarians than one might anticipate. I'm quite frankly very uncomfortable with the Vatican's position that seems to be moving towards a stance that will bar gay men from studies for the priesthood. I think that would be a mistake.
Is that the direction you see it heading in?
I'm afraid I do. The Vatican has already indicated that gay men should not be admitted. And even Dr. Joachim Navarro-Valls, the Vatican spokesperson, has questioned the very validity of the ordination of gay priests. That's going to be very problematic if we move in that direction.
What are some of the problems?
Well, first of all, who determines that an individual has a homosexual orientation? I think that has to come from the individual himself or herself. And in terms of candidates for the priesthood, if a man feels that God is calling him to the priesthood, I think he's going to be put into a situation where he just won't indicate that he happens to have a gay orientation. How do you enforce that kind of a policy that gay men should not be admitted? I also feel it's a problem for gay priests today, committed celibate priests who feel that they are being scapegoated in terms of the sexual abuse scandal. We have so many faithful, effective gay priests and indeed gay bishops that I think it would be a huge administrative problem and a terrible public relations position for the church to assume, should indeed it argue that gay candidates for the priesthood would not be admitted into our seminaries.
In response to the crisis in the church, several New groups have formed, groups of laity, groups of priests. One of the groups of laity is called Voice of the Faithful. And one of the slogans mm-hmm. of theirs I've seen is Keep the Faith, Change the Church. Their goals are to support those who've been sexually abused, to support priests of integrity, and to support structural change within the church. As a priest looking at this group, what do you make of it?
I have a great deal of respect for Voices of the Faithful. I think they're trying to set a moderate agenda. I think they precisely want to keep the faith. And they're talking about changing the church in those areas where the church indeed is free to change. A greater role for the laity in the church, appropriate accountability. At the present time, the accountability in the church, as it is in most feudal systems, is upward. But there doesn't seem to be any kind of horizontal accountability or downward accountability. Voices of the Faithful, I think, is aptly named. We're hearing from people who are indeed faithful and who love the church very much, and actually they're going to point the way out and through the present crisis we're in. I'm convinced of that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you, Terry.
Father Donald Cousins, his new book is called Sacred Silence. This is NPR, National Public Radio.